This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
But simply to note for you that he will have a new collection out this year with Scribner's called Roots and Branches, and that presently he has, I think, two books in print, Selected Poems with City Life and The Opening of the Field with Grove Press. All otherwise that I'd like for my own relation to emphasize is that this sense of poetry that Mr. Duncan is involved with is that which for me is primary, that which takes place not only in the ambitions of the writer, which are finally of really no interest to any of us, but in the context of the language as fact and act, in the context of all impulse that generates the human possibility for any one of us. And with that, I would really like to introduce to you Mr. Robert Duncan.
I'm going to take the opportunity of this reading for doing something that I have not done today, and that is not reading from my published work, but reading from the book that is about to be published, and then reading at the close. I don't think it's necessary. Is that off now? Yeah. I think you can all hear me, unless somebody deaf has been seated in the back row. I'm going to take the opportunity of reading from Roots and Branches, and then at the close of the reading, in which case it might get through to me. So, we only have to go now between 8:10 and 9 o'clock. This place will have a break, and that will give me make it possible for me also to. I'll have a little sense of how absolutely undone or with it you are, and then I can organize. And after that, I will be reading some new things that will not be in the book. I'm going to start with the first poem. I'm going to go somewhat in sequence and maybe make some remarks along the line. I would like to talk about. As a matter of fact, for my own information, because when I have never before taken this book and tried to give an account of it as I go along, give some idea of how it seemed to me when I was writing it. First place, I had finished the opening of the field, and the opening of the field was, in a way, a very carefully planned volume. It had a thematic development throughout the volume, so that certain poems would happening at certain times belong to meanings that I had was constantly thinking of in relation both to myths, actualities about a field, the physical nature of the field, so forth. Now, at the conclusion of that volume, I felt that everything of that kind was holding me in, and I wanted to open up somewhat, let poems go loose again, turn into an amateur again. I felt very professional in relation to the opening of the field. I wanted a volume that would certainly be vulnerable. And I even went back to earlier rhetorical styles of mine that I myself was uneasy about in order to re-experience that unease and find out what was in it. So the very first poem that I wrote, it is not the very first poem I wrote after the opening of the field, but the one that gave the title to the volume is the first poem in the volume. I was sitting in Stinson Beach on a veranda looking out. When we had moved to Stinson Beach, I had suddenly realized that I was in the presence of a series of rhythms that were all around me, constantly speaking to me, and that I could not understand how they could enter the poem. One was the not repetitious nor monotonous sound of the surf. You have only to live on a seashore. Your first impression of the seashore is that you're in the presence of the monotony, and you soon realize that it's not, and that's why it enchains you. It hypnotizes you because it does not repeat. And this particular day, though, was an early day of spring. For us, spring comes a little earlier than it does to Albuquerque, so that along about March, in the early part of March, everything has broken into the first green. Not the first. It'll come in February. But also vast flocks, millions, is the impression of monarch butterflies come along the coast of California the whole vista becomes another series of rhythms, the movements of monarch butterflies, and statistically so many of them that it is like the surf. So I was looking at a visual rhythm, a series of breakings away and contours that led down to the seashore. I was hearing the surf, and now that's not in this poem, but I suddenly saw, no, I can't cope with it. So I had wanted to start a whole period in which I would admit in a way I couldn't cope with it. And right away I wrote down roots and branches. It seemed to me that what I was seeing in the movements of these butterflies was like the entanglements of roots and branches going everywhere. And above and below, branching out, rooting out, who knows? There are roots that are in the air, and it seemed to me too there were branches that were in the underworld, in the under earth, what we were. Sail monarchs, rising and falling, orange merchants in spring's flowery markets, messengers of March in warm currents of news floating, flitting into areas of aroma, tracing out of air unseen roots and branches of sense I share in thought, filaments woven and broken where the world might light casual certainties of me. There are echoes of what I am in what you perform this morning, how you perfect my spirit, almost restore an imaginary tree of the living in all its doctrines by fluttering about, intent and easy as you are, the profusion of you, awakening transports of an inner view of things. John Lewis was doing a second or third issue of a magazine called Measure, and wanted to do the issue on magic, wrote me a letter and said he wanted me to do an article on the Kabbalah. There are times when such a letter coming to me, and later I will read a poem, another poem, which was of this type, suddenly strike off in me an immediacy, not an answer, but as if they had given me the gift of what a poem would be. And right upon opening that letter from John Wieners, I sat down and wrote this poem which follows. What do I know of the old lore? A young editor wants me to write on Kabbalah for his magazine. What do I know of the left and the right, of the Shekinah, of the Metatron? It is an old book lying on the velvet cloth, the color of olive underleaf and plum stain in the velvet. It is a romance of pain and relief from pain, a tale told of the Lord of the Hour of Midnight, the changing over that is a going down into day from the mountain. Ah, the seed that lies in the sweetness of the Kabbalah is the thought of those rabbis rejoicing in their common devotions, of the thousand threads of their trinities, praises, wisdoms, shared loves and curses interwoven. There are terrible things in the design they weave, fair and unfair, established in one. How all the righteousness is founded upon Jacob's cheat upon cheat, and the devout pray continually for the humiliation and defeat of Esau, for everlasting terror and pain to eat at the Nephilim. The ways of the old Jews talking persist at the shore. Oh, I know nothing of the left and the right. The moon that moves the waters comes clear from the earth's shadow. All the old fears that have been drawn up into the mountain that comes of knowing. It is an old book of stories. The Bible is an old book of stories. A mirror made by goblins for that ice queen, the Shekinah, a likelihood of our hearts withheld from healing. A young editor wants me to write on Kabbalah for his magazine. Yes, for I too loved the scene of dark magic, the sorcerers sending up clouds of empire and martyrdom, the gem made by goblins yielding its secret gold to the knowing, enchantresses coming in to the lodestone, the star that Adam dreams, angels in their goblin splendors of eyes and fires, left and right ascending the ladders of heaven. El Elyon walking in the cool of his garden. That must be all stones and gold, radioactive flowings, molten glasses of the old volcano. For the Kabbalah does not praise artichokes, nor the emerald of lettuce that has a light. What do I know of the left and the right, who have a left hand and a right hand? Do I put my left foot forward? the rabbis stop under the lemon tree, rejoicing in the cool of its leaves, which they say is the cool of the leaves of that tree of trees. Look, Rabbi Eliezer says, the glory of the Shekinah shines from lettuces in the name of that garden. Already this poem, with its long lines, was writing in a direction which I have always felt as thought of as being disapproved of, and actually have is disapproved at large. The poem I'm now going to read, Night Scenes, somewhat humorously, at the time when Night Scenes was written, I was still in the glow, as far as San Francisco went, of their entire approval of the opening of the field. And so the legend of San Francisco was that through, particularly since some poems immediately following Night Scenes, I contributed to local San Francisco magazines that were, I certainly had the approval of a group of poets at home. And then some 2 years later, when I was no longer contributing to their magazines, Night Scenes appeared in The Floating Bear. It is hard to explain to you certain factors of the literary world, but San Francisco thinks that New York does not exist, or that if you do appear in New York, it is like really selling out to the goyim. And I am certainly more and more known for somebody that if there's so much as $2 in it, we'll sell out to the goyim. Now, there was no money in it in Floating Bear, so that they were even more outraged. They wanted to sell it out for nothing to the goyim. When Night Scenes was written, 2 years after it was written, I was at the opposite stasis with the poets of San Francisco. So that Night Scenes was read in ridicule. I was not present, I am glad to say. I don't think they would have dared, because I'm rather fierce about such matters. But I was away, and it was read in ridicule, and it was read as an example of how appalling my writing had become, because I had been very wicked, except for the fact that it had been 2 years before the time I was supposed to have been wicked. But you will see when I read Night Scenes that it is rhetorical. It was a real, what is that sound? That one. Well, I won't pay attention to it because I guess I'm... But the pace of it, I couldn't keep up with that. Kippresentations. After my mother's death in December 1960, there were two returns of her presence in February and March of 1961. The first came in a dream. We send you word of the mother. Was it my mother? Our mother? In the dream, it was a blessing or a key. She brought a message. Was it H.D.'s frail script? It was she, I thought, but the sign was of another. It was a help, for my mind is in great trouble to receive the letter. But I was cold, lying in the narrow bed, naked. When did I lie there so? The first light of morning came in over me, a cold, thin wave where nerves shrank back from the bruise. Who gave me the note? Only I accused myself of lying here in the cold, shaking in the drafts of light, hugging to the scant cover. Hug, for I have lost heart. My mind is divided. Afterthoughts, November 1961. Working on the H.D. book, I had begun to fear her death as a forfeit or foundation of the work. My mother, in whom I took my first nature, the formal imperative of my physical body and signature, died when I was born. I was motherless then, in the cold, for 6 months before my second mother found and adopted me. But the "when did I lie there so" seems to refer to some cold back of this period of loss, as in turn the mother is back of my mother's. When I was born, what gave birth to me fell back dead or died in the labor toward my success. Was she alive or dead when I drew my first breath and uttered throughout my first cry? In taking heart, another heart was lost. What blessing, what key, then? 2. In the change from my birth name, Edward Howard Duncan, to my name by adoption, Robert Edward Sims, the hidden or lost name is Howard. The second presentation came when I was riding the Union Howard bus line from the marina to North Beach. I had begun a poem addressed to my mother when the hysterical talk of a schoolgirl broke in, dictating fragments of a message that seemed meant for me and at the same time to direct the poem. You are gone, and I send, as I used to, with a salutation, dear mother, the beginning of a letter, as if it could reach you. Yet dear mother could reach at my heart to say, did when I was a child, as you are now a child among shades, as if the words betrayed a painful nearness and separation. It's a poem I wrote, and I called it My Soul. Was she talking to me? Her voice carries above the din of high school girls chattering, crowding the bus with shrill bird voices. It's this poem I wrote, see? She waits, and when I look up from where I am writing, did she see me writing here? How did I hear her voice if not directed in the crowd to me? Laughing, the fat little Hindu girl turns her eyes to my glance, triumphant. I write so many, see, all the time, and this one I lost. That's why I say I lost my soul. Does she say anything that comes into her head to hold my attention? Well, you didn't go over and pull me out, she shouts to some girl I can't see. I had such a cramp in my leg and I almost drowned. I thought I was all alone. Like that, then, her voice came through to me, swimming in the flood of voices as if alone, catching my attention. A sheaf of poems hysterical girls might carry on about, their souls, their names. Loves? You'll never love anyone, you said, mother, so long ago. Caught in the swirl of waters, bobbing heads of the young girls, pubescent, descending from the bus, pass on or out into the street beyond. One. Dark Hindu face among them passes out of my ken. Are you out there alone then, like that? Or did your own mother come close in to meet you as your sister, looking forward or back from her 80 years, said, mother will be there when I die, waiting for me, her throat catching at the evocation. But of that other great mother or meter of the matter, my letter always went alone to where I never knew you reading. In the middle of H.D.'s long poem, with phrases of it, and with my own associations, and with many ideas that are distant from most of our common ideas, I'm going to read it, let's say, as a song of a kind. And so don't... It will let it come and go, as I did. Actually, I think of the poem as things at play often, and I think of a play or drama as really a play. Let's say you have a cast, or you have also a little like, well, not like juggling, because in juggling you have to have some system whereby you really, in succession, keep all of those the things you're juggling moving, whereas in a play of a thing, you really can have them move in a much more wide way. So let these things play without worrying about knowing that if you were interested later or you already knew some things, there might be a little... I play with little secrets in and out. That's part of what the poem itself talks about. What time of day is it? What day of the month? H.D. read Quatrième for Quantième in Paris. Today, the sky is overcast. Doves that might be her nuns, gray, the light diffuse. The light's everywhere diffused, Yet we must take our direction from the sun's quarter, as if accurately obey. I can't remember. Are the bees confused? I can't find the bee book, the way books can get out of hand. They fly by polarized light, take their way in dance, making their map, as we likewise in song keep time. But if you lose something, you look everywhere. He's angry because I disturbed lunch, asking where is the bee book, and could not figure out, would they lose their way, the sun track, under cloud ceiling of gray, the katriam, or as we might, lose the day of the month, as if in song its key, not know what moon and what season? I do not remember bees working over the garden on such a day, but in the full sunlight, the warmth of its fire hums, and covered with pollens, the honey gatherers go to the heart of things, shaking and waking the flowery horns, taking the sweetest song to fill their dark combs. In the poem there is, "Are you dead in the darkness? Who sleeps in the hive where the queen's honey is mixed?" Which they prepare by what we call instinct, as if they were sure, nursing their own Isis, générateur, générante, the poem calls her, drones, and that other dreamer or mother of them all, who ordered or ordained or controlled this. The goddess or nurse commands, write, write or die. We too write instinctively, like bees, serve the life of the hive. Covered with pollens out of time, gold of the hour, tumble, fly under maps of the sun's measure, on wings, words that are winds, melodies, in the song's light, stored in the queen's ward. But the truth, he told me, was he wasn't angry about lunch. It was because I hid what I wanted from myself, made the ease of the thing impossible, teaching the mind not to find the sun's rhyme, setting the whole house into an uproar. Is it one? Is it tone? Is it imagination? What word are you looking for? In a mimeographed lesson of Dr. Quimby on the subconscious, I find he also calls it the book, and he said, we are not any wiser than the book we have written. Where the bees came in, came to mind from their place or time, and to this place misplaced, when I remembered not where the book was, but their song in the sun. On June 8, 1961, news came that H.D. had had a stroke. In July, Norman Holmes Pearson wrote, the part of the brain which controls speech has been injured, so that she cannot recall appropriate words at will. Yet she does have fiercely the desire to communicate, and strikes her breast in passionate frustration when there is no word at her tongue's tip. Sometimes whole sentences will come, sometimes everything but the key word. So it is I want, but one can never tell what it is she wants. Doves. Mother of mouthings, the gray doves in your many branches code and decode what warnings we can recall of love's watery tones. She raises the bedroom window to let in the air and pearl gray light of morning, where the first world stripped of its names extends, where initial things go, beckoning dove sounds recur, taking what we know of them. And the soul leaps to the tongue's tip, as if to tell what secret in the word for it. The bird's claw scraping the ledges. I hear the rustling of wings. Is it evening? The woodwinds chortling or piping, sounds settling down in the dark pit where the orchestra lights glow as the curtain rises. And in the living room, at another stage, lamps are lit. The lady in the shade of the boughs held a dove in her two hands, let it fly up from the bowl she made, as if a word had left her lips. Now that the song has flown, the tree shakes, rustling in the wind, with no stars of its own, for all the nets of words are gone. The lady holds nothing in her two hands, cupped, The catches of the years are torn, and the wood light floods and overflows the bowl she holds like a question. Voices of children from playgrounds come, sounding on the wind without names. We cannot tell who they are there. We were once two under what stars. Before words, after words, hands lifted as a bowl for water, arms a prayer. For what we heard was no more than a dove's hurr, hurr, hurr. Where the day slept, afternoon, in the light's blur and shade, the queen of the trees talking. Here's only the leaf sound, hurr, of wings in the boughs. The voices in the wind verging into leaf sound. I wanted to say something, that my heart had such a burden, or needed a burden in order to say something. Take what mask to find words, and as an old man come forward into a speech he had long waited for, had on the tip of his tongue, from which now, oh, fateful thread, sentence that through my song most moved, now from your courses the flame has fled, making but words of what I love. I'm going to read now with a breath. A poem I'm at work on, so it will not be. In any way, this poem is intended as a sequence of like. I've been more. I went through a period in which I reacted against the cantos because it seemed to me the pound was always. After all, we had no other poems but the cantos, and the pound began on the cantos. Many different fascinations with the cantos. They've always been central. I began with the cantos at about the age of 18 or 19, and all my life have had many different ideas of them. Now, recently, I've been haunted by them again, and they seem to me this time to open up a great freedom. That is a freedom in relation to the way in which I compose things thematically all the way through. And I thought if I would open up, let's say, call something just passages, as you might call something just fragments, try to prevent it from forming into a poem as the Pindar poem or Apprehensions formed into a total, a symphonic. The symphonic form, or the sonata form, fascinated me. I like to orchestrate a large poem. I like to have related movements and boxes, poems within poems. And now I wanted to see if I could let that loose. Now, of course, I can't do it immediately. You'll find thematic progressions in this. But I have begun this poem in order to see if I can open up and eventually have some of these passages much more free of it. There is a kind of poem that I have never in my life been able to do, and that really fascinates me, a total form, which Williams is Spring and All. Now, you see, the later Williams is very much what I do do. All the later Williams is thematically composed and has a regular musical progression. But in Spring and All, there is a sequence of, I don't know, what is it, something like 32 poems. It's much more than you could ever compose except by your intuition. So that's what I'm sort of going toward, and yet, certainly at the beginning of this poem, you won't find it opening yet. I'm going to read as far as I have typed, and because this will be the first time I've read these in public. This is the first time, by the way, I've read that H.D. poem in public, and so the previous time I was certainly not ready for it. I wasn't quite ready this time. I can't get, it's one of the few poems that I can't get my distance from. And I am, for me, the poem is a distance, not a feeling. I mean, but my feeling is so mixed up with the feeling of the poem, is the way I put it. I know the distance is there in the poem, but I am still, have not made mine with it. I did make mine in writing it, by the way. That's why it's no justice when I am that mixed up with it. I mean, I tried my best and actually, for the poem to come clear, my emotional mix-up with it would have to disappear so you were hearing it and not distressed because I was still unhappy, because I still had grief. But I am going, because it is important to me, this idea that the poem is not an expression at all of grief. It can contain even grief, because grief in a poem is a poetic entity. Perhaps it is really a gift to read that poem to show you how you can still be mixed up and not yet have given the poem what it has. It, certainly the poem is its own, not mine, in it. Eventually it will be there. Of course, most people I know are moved by a poem when the writer's emotion is there. But I am offering, I have a contrary view of the real thing a poem is. Okay, passages. From Julian, Hymn to the Mother of the Gods. And Attis encircles the heavens like a tiara, and thence sets out as though to descend to earth. For the even is bounded, but the uneven is without bounds, and there is no way through or out of it. And to her without bounds I send, wherever she wanders, by what campfire at evening, among tribes setting each the city where we, her people, are, at the end of a day's reaches, here the eternal lamps lit, here the wavering human sparks of heat and light glimmer, go out and reappear. So this is the company of the living, and the poet's voice speaks from no crevice in the ground between mid-earth and underworld, breathing fumes of what is deadly to know, news, larvae, and tombs, and twists of time do feed upon, but from the hearthstone, the lamp light, the heart of the matter where the house is held. Yet here, the warning light at the edge of town. The city will go out in time, will go out into time, hiding even its embers, and we were scattered throughout the countries and times of man, for we took alarm in ourselves. Rumors of the enemy spread among the feathers of the wing that covered us. Mnemosyne they named her, the mother of the whispering feathered wing. Memory, the great speckled bird who broods over the nest of soul, and her egg, the dream in which all things are living, I return to, leaving myself. I'm beside myself in this thought of the one in the world egg, enclosed in the shell of murmurings, rhymed round, sound-chambered child. It's that first. The fourth going to be bursts into green as the spring winds blow watery from the south and the sun returns north. He hides fire among words in his mouth and comes racing out of the zone of dark and storm towards us. I sleep in the afternoon, retreating from work, reading and dropping away from the reading as if I were only a seed of myself, unawakened, unwilling to sleep or wake. A cat. Burr and the whir, thick, thick, thick of Kierke's loom and Pound's cantos. I heard a song of that kind. My mind a shuttle among set strings of the music, lets a weft of dream grow in the daytime, an increment of associations, luminous, soft threads, the thrown glamour crossing and recrossing, the twisted sinews underlying the work. Back of the images, the few chords that bind meaning and the word flow, the rivering web rises among wits and senses, gathering wool into its full cloth. The secret is hid in the showing forth. The white cat kneads its paws and sheathes his eyes in ecstasy against the light. The light bounding from his fur as from a shield held high in the midst of a battle. What does the worm work in his cocoon? There was such a want in the old ways when craft came into our elements. Art shall never work free of that forge, that loom, that lyre, the fire, the images, the voice. Why, even in the room where we are, reading to ourselves, or I'm reading aloud, sounding the music, the stuff vanishes upon the air, line after line thrown. Let there be the clack of the shuttle fly forward and back, warp, whirp, warp, cast of a net, a laying of eggs from warp to throw, the threads twisted for strength, that can be a warp of the will. O weaver, weaver, work no more, Gascoigne is quoted, thy warp hath done me wrong. And the shuttle carrying the woof I find with scootle, harpoon, a dart, an arrow, or a little ship, navicula, Weberschiff, crossing and recrossing from shore to shore. Prehistoric scootle, scoot, a bolt, a bar, as of a door, a floodgate. But the battle I saw was on a wide plain for the sake of valor, the hand trained to the bow, the man's frame withstanding, each side, facing its foe for the sake of the alliance, allegiance, the legion, that the vow that makes a nation, one body, not be broken. Yet it is all, we know, a melee, a medley of mistaken themes, grown dreadful and surmounting dread, so that Achilles may have his wrath and throw down the heroic Hector who raised that reflection of the heroic in his shield. I'd cut the warp to weave that web in the air, and here let image perish in image, leave writer and reader up in the air to draw momentous inconclusions. Ropes of the first water returned by a rhetoric, the rain swells. Statistically insignificant as a locus of creation, I have in this my own intense area of self-creation, the sun itself, insignificant among suns. The magi of the probable bring forth a mirror, an iridescent, an ocean, which I hold in the palm of my hand, as if I could cast a shadow to surround what is boundless, as if I could handle this pearl that touches upon every imagination of what I am. Wrong about the web, the reflection, the lure of the world I love. The moon, so pleasing, a light, round, haloed, partially disclosed, a ring, night's wedding signet, maybe a great lady drawing her tight skirts up in whirls and loosening to the gilt shore margins of her sea robes. Or he, his consent releasing dreams, the dazzling path remaining over the waves, a lord too, lunar moth king, Oberon gleaming amidst clouds. From what source the light of their faces, the light of their eyes, the dark glance that illumines, the kindling look, as if over the shimmer of the lake, his flesh radiant. My lord and lady moon, upon whom, as if with love, the sun at the source of light reflects, lifted, Mount Shasta in snowy reverie, floats. I'll sing two songs that I like to sing, and I use every possible reading to do it. The first one is one that is in the opening of the field, a song of the old order. Sing fair the lady and her knight. Sing the two friends, brothers or lovers who keep troth, and praise the man and the woman naked betrothed who give green to the earth and by their love raise the day's light. These things we sing fair from the earliest time, burnt leaf of November and green of May. The change of the year, the rounds of the moon, we sing in our measures and return with our rhyme. For our lady waxeth and waneth, Joan grows sullen and Joan delights, burnt leaf of November and green of May. These things we number among our delights, burnt leaf of November and green of May. The replenishing work and play we devote to the troth we keep, the source of light that is right, right, as the stars and the courses bind the dark. For our Lord has awakened our hearts, John has known grief and John has known joy, burnt leaf of November and green of May. Know you your father who gave you your name, burnt leaf of November and green of May? Oh, show me my brother by night and by day, for the way I go is by your side, the dance whose figures may measure man's pride. For the Lord has redeemed the abyss, He gave the new law, he suffered the kiss, burnt leaf of November and green of May. These things we adore, the bindings of law, burnt leaf of November and green of May, that gives us new courage, that gave us to love, one in whose likeness we discover the day. For Our Lady gives and returns us, she teaches all and she hides the key, burnt leaf of November and green of May. Sing, Fair the Lady and her knight, sing the two friends, brothers or lovers, who keep troth and praise, praise the man and the woman, naked betrothed, who give green to the earth, and by their love raise the day's light. The time I wrote this, when I write a song, there is a tune that goes with it, and certainly I had begun to dawn on me when I wrote this song that perhaps the reason that poetry and music became separated, that the troubadours were doing all right, except that all of a sudden up came a bunch of singers who were competing, and as we all know, I mean, if you've ever heard a composer singing something they set, it's really quite a weird experience. And so gradually a bunch of Frank Sinatras crowded out all those poets and later complained about why aren't poets singing. And all we had was Carl Sandburg in between. I thought maybe I could dare, you know, public, no one, I mean, we can all be graceful about what it's like, except this tune really does come along with a verse for me. Now, this is one that was in the middle of a Halloween mask, and it's sung by a country wife, and it has a different tone. Now, if you doubt my story, you'll never find me out. I'll gather wool from the gallows tree and knit my bridal shroud. When I was but a young girl, my mother said to me, ye think you'll marry yon bonny Carl, and ye will faithful be. But the moon will change, and so will you. I'll teach you a devil's trick or two, a simple charm t'will do no harm. For a wife can lie at her husband's side, and dance besides with the green men pipe, and ancient crones with their lusty drones betray the honeymoon. When I was still a willing wife, old Gowdy said to me, you're all the stay for the married life, and ye would faithful be. But the human heart will run about and is faithless as the sea. I'll teach you woman's way to sew a fancy trick with stone and stick, when you'll know not whether to stay or go. For a wife can lie at her husband's side and dance besides with a green man's pipe, and souls are lost to double cross beneath the honeymoon. Now if you doubt my story, I'll change my tune for you. I'd ravel the shroud in a thorn tree and let the ends hang loose. When I was first an adulteress, my lover said to me, when you were born, you were one of us, and I have set you free. For few are those that God once chose, when first the human lot he cast, the rest are pickings for the crows and base iniquity. I'll teach you a faithless ruse to try, when lust hides out in your sleepless eye, a puppet face to take your place. For a wife can lie at her husband's side and dance besides the green men fight for the fairy feast and fucking the beast behind the honeymoon. And now that I've lived 40 years, my mother spoke most true. My eyes have used up all their tears. I've known the cold the whole world fears, and I have much to rue. But I've learned to play the fickle moon and leave my traces where I come to pray my pace or noster back. First the white and then the black. The time is late and the hour comes soon. For a wife can lie at her husband's side and dance besides with green men pipe, leaping there in the shape of a hare betimes the honeymoon.